Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to this installment of Witness to Yesterday, the podcast of the Champlain Society. My name is Greg Marshallden, and today we are going to talk to Graham Fraser about the journal kept by F.R. Scott and what it tells us about the history of the Royal Commission on Bilingualism and Biculturalism, the famous B&B Commission. Graham Fraser is a former journalist who served as Canada's sixth Commissioner of Official Languages between 2006 and 2016. He's also a writer who has published in both official languages of Canada. An officer of the Order of Canada, he's currently associated with the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Ottawa. The Fate of Canada, F.R. Scott's Journal of the Royal Commission on Bilingualism and Biculturalism, 1963 to 1971, was published by McGill Queen's University Press in 2021. Graham, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
As you know, the Champlain Society, which sponsors this podcast, is in the business of editing journals, diaries, and other original material that can shed a light on Canada's history. Your book is very much in this tradition. So tell us why you concluded that Scott's journal should be published at all, and how did you go about the job of editing his journal?
Over the years, I've always been interested in Scott's work, and I guess I first discovered the existence of the journal in reading Sandra Joie's biography of Frank Scott, and went through the journal in the archives for a book that I wrote on language policy, and then again for a lecture at McGill. And I was always very conscious of the fact that André Laurendeau's had also kept a journal. His journal had been published in French and translated into English. And so I always thought, well, Laurendeau's journal was published, Scott should be as well. And so when I finished as my tenure as Commissioner of Official Languages, I thought, well, this would be a natural next project to embark on. I naively thought that I could print out the journal, get it from the archives, modify the lecture I'd given as an introduction, and have it out a year after I'd stepped down as commissioner. There are a number of reasons it took me 5 years rather than the 1 year that I had thought it would take. It turned out to be a more complex job than I had figured.
Yeah, editing journals of this type is always a very painstaking job, as we know at the Champlain Society. What we're really interested in today is the sort of the figure of F.R. Scott. Can you give us a thumbnail biography of him? He was a poet, a law professor, a socialist, a constitutionalist. He also was very paradoxical in some ways. Can you give us a flavor of this person?
He was. He was, as you say, he was a socialist and very much out of step with McGill. That McGill really would have preferred that he was not a public figure on the left in the 1930s and 40s and 50s. But he was also very much a part of the elite. He was the youngest son of an Anglican minister in Quebec City. He was a Rhodes Scholar. He'd been at Oxford with Lester Pearson. David Lewis, who worked with him in the CCF and the NDP, talked about his aloofness and the degree to which he could be condescending to people who intervened, and sometimes cruel in his put-downs. But he had a wicked sense of humor. Michael Oliver said that you could hear him two rooms away from his laughter at parties. There was a kind of mythic quality to him. He had taken on Maurice Duplessis, the premier of Quebec, taken him to the Supreme Court on the padlock law and on the banning of Lady Chatterley's lover. Of all the principles that he believed in and supported, the pleasure principle was certainly one of them.
You have a personal connection to F.R. Scott. Did this connection play any role in your decision to publish Scott's journal?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, my parents jointly owned a summer cottage in North Hatley with the Scotts, which meant that we overlapped now and then, but because they had it in July and we had it in August, the fact that we were joint owners didn't mean a lot of contact with the Scots. But I certainly have very vivid memories of him. One point when I was a child and we were there at the same time and had gone on a picnic down Lake Massawippi, he was in a canoe paddling and capsized the canoe. And I thought he'd done it on purpose and said, "Do it again, Mr. Scott, do it again." He told me once that he had talked to a scientist in Montreal about the experiment that had been done with rats, where there was an electric node that went directly to the brain that stimulated pleasure. And if they banged on a lever, this would send a little electric shock directly to the pleasure point in the brain. And they would bang away, stomp away on this lever until they collapsed and not eat or drink and would continue. So he said that from then on, every time he or then this scientist saw each other at cocktail parties, they would stomp their feet furiously, like those mice or rats in the experiment. I was able to pick, and we have mutual family friends, so collected my fair share of Scott's stories, because he is someone that that people tended to talk about, and he was witty, he was erudite, and had enormous charm. But that wasn't really why I decided to embark on it. Even though that cottage, which I now own, has some memorabilia from that era. It has the beer stein that his law students gave him when he retired from as dean. So I've always had a sense of Scott being present in my life, if you like. But it was more that I thought that He had made a very important contribution to the Royal Commission. As Commissioner of Official Languages, and before that as somebody who wrote about language policy, always felt that the Commission played a critical role in laying the groundwork for Canada's language policy. I always had enormous respect for Scott. And embarking on the diary, I discovered a degree of nuance in Scott's thinking about this that I had not originally been aware of.
Well, on this last point about his role in the commission, I note that the commission is colloquially known as Laurendeau-Dutton Commission, not Laurendeau-Scott. But it seems to me that Scott played a pretty critical role, virtually as a co-chair at times. But I'd like to know your opinion after going through the journal.
Well, I've always thought that the primary debate, if you like, was between Laurendeau and Scott, certainly in the first 5 years. But there's a degree to which history tends to be more interested in those people who leave a written record. And Scott and Laurendeau, in leaving journals, left a record in a way that Davidson Dunton did not. I'm not sure that had Scott been co-chair, the commission would have been as skilled at reaching a consensus. Scott, for all of his strengths, was not a consensus builder, whereas both Laurendeau and Dunton were consensus builders. Scott was logical, driven, not particularly tolerant of people he disagreed with, after Laurendeau's death, Scott wrote a tribute to him in Le Devoir in which he explicitly expressed his admiration for how Laurendeau was prepared to patiently listen to people with whom he totally and violently disagreed. That was not one of Scott's own characteristics, but I think it was part of the reason that the Royal Commission was able to emerge so successfully in its final report. And Dunton doesn't leave a record in the same way that Laurendeau and Scott do, but I think that Davidson Dunton was a natural conciliator, and I think behind the scenes played an important role in bringing people together. He was also, to a degree that Laurendeau was not, able to round the corners and smooth the wheels in the dealings with the government. Laurendeau really felt like a fish out of water in Ottawa. Dunton lived in Ottawa, was the president of Carleton University, and was very comfortable reassuring, conveying messages back and forth to the government about the importance of the commission being able to continue its mandate as long as it did.
Well, just before we return to Scott, just tell us a little bit more about the commission itself. It ran from 1963 to 1970. What was its mandate? What did it accomplish? And from my perspective, given I was on a royal commission for a year and a half, it's all the time we were given, why did it take so long for this commission to complete its work?
Well, for one thing, the mandate was pretty vast. It was, and I'm quoting here from the mandate, to report upon the situation and practice of bilingualism within all branches and agencies of the federal administration, including Crown corporations, and in their communications with the public, and to make recommendations designed to ensure the bilingual and basically bicultural character of the federal administration, 2, to report on the role of public and private organizations, including the mass communications media, in promoting bilingualism, better cultural relations, and a more widespread appreciation of the basically bicultural character of the country and of the subsequent contribution made by the other cultures, and to recommend what should be done to improve that role, and having regard to the fact that the constitutional jurisdiction over education is vested in the provinces, to discuss with the provincial governments the opportunities available to Canadians to learn the English and French languages, and to recommend what could be done to enable Canadians to become bilingual. Now, one of the reasons it went on so long, there were three stages, if you like, of the commission hearings. There was the initial stage of listening to people in public hearings across the country. There was the stage of drawing up the first report, which was the most important. That was the one that laid out the recommendations for an Official Languages Act and the creation of the position of Commissioner of Official Languages. The subsequent reports that dealt with other ethnic groups and a variety of other aspects came later. But to a large extent, the reason it lasted so long was it failed to reach an agreement on constitutional recommendations. To that extent, it was kind of a preview of the failure to over the Michelet Accord and the whole constitutional crisis debates of the late 80s and early 90s. So, and you see those debates playing out in the latter years, and they reached a deadlock, and as Royce Frith said, finally agreed that they could not agree on constitutional recommendations. So that latter part between, if you like, 69 and 71 was where they were locked in disagreement. And they were locked in disagreement also. There was a consensus that they would not publish the report that had been drafted on mass media because they just didn't think it was well enough done.
So, returning to Scott, I know him as a member of the League for Social Reconstruction. I know him as a CCF activist and one of the key authors of the Regina Manifesto of 1933. To what extent did his socialist views mark him out in the commission, separate him maybe from the other members of the commission? And even more importantly, did his socialist or collectivist leanings shape his views concerning language rights and bilingualism?
Well, it's interesting. Where it emerges most clearly was that he felt that the commission should be speaking out against the commercialization of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation and the role of corporations in Canadian life generally. In a moving section of a piece that he wrote called The End of the Affair, he expressed real regret that what he saw as the positive collectivist communitarian aspect of the Roman Catholic Church, which he had always denounced in the 1930s, that it in its gradual loss of power in Quebec, that he felt that collectivist communitarian sense was being lost as well, and that capitalism was winning. So that marked him aside from the others. Royce Frith, whom he agreed with on all kinds of other things, owned a private radio station and so was dead set against the commission taking position on the commercials on the CBC, for example. In terms of language policy, he had always felt that there was a protection for groups, more protection for groups in the British North America Act than there was for individuals. But that was not really recognized by the French-speaking members of the commission. André Landau had difficulty understanding exactly where Scott was coming from and asked Léon Dion, who was a friend of Landau's and a professor at Laval and also worked for the commission, asked him to do a paper on Scott's worldview. And Dion said that Scott's view, in contrast to Landau's, that Landau was collectivist and pessimistic, and that Scott was individualist and optimistic. And I think that was a fundamental misreading of Scott's socialism and collectivist approach. But where, and many Quebec academics still view Scott as an anti-nationalist, partly because of his support for Pierre Trudeau, his support for Trudeau during the introduction of the War Measures Act. I think that is a profound misreading of Scott's position. Scott did not oppose seeing French Canada or Quebec as a nation. He felt that English Canada was not a nation, that it did not have contiguous parts. It did not represent a common culture. All that bounded English Canada together was language, in his view. And whereas he did recognize that French Canada represented a nation, he just didn't think the boundaries of that nation were the boundaries of the province of Quebec. He felt it was a nation that covered all of French Canada. And this was at a period where certainly Landau and many other nationalists in Quebec were redefining French Canadian nationalism as Quebec nationalism. And Scott, as an English Quebecer, saw this as a threat to the English community.
Pushing that further, what was Scott's precise view of the two nations theory, at least as revealed in this journal?
He didn't believe that in the two nation theory because he didn't think English Canada was a nation. He thought that, and he, at one point, even though he insisted that the French Canadian nation extended beyond the boundaries of Quebec, at times the vocabulary would shift within a couple of paragraphs, he had no problem recognizing that French Canada or Quebec did have all the characteristics of a nation and could be called a nation, but he didn't think English Canada could.
So to what extent was Scott responsible then for the commission's preliminary report of July 1964? And at that point, as you point out in the book, the commission states that Canadians in Canada was passing through the greatest crisis in its history. Scott himself wrote that. What did he mean by crisis?
In the introduction of the preliminary report, it has that dramatic phrase, which is probably the only single phrase from the Royal Commission that anybody who remembers the Royal Commission at all can remember clearly, that without fully realizing it, Canada is passing through the greatest crisis in its history. And it took quite a while for the commissioners to reach that conclusion and to decide that they would write that preliminary report. And it was a meeting in Quebec City, which was basically dominated by indépendantistes, separatists at the meeting. And Landau was shouted down. It shook the commissioners in a way that they had not been shaken at any of the previous public meetings. And that, I think, was a tipping point for them in deciding that, yes, it's a crisis, and yes, we're going to come out with a preliminary report saying so. And what Scott said in his note to his fellow commissioners in July 1964 was his description of what the crisis was. in saying there's a crisis, and a very serious crisis in Canada, we mean that in our opinion, there has occurred a permanent shift of opinion in Quebec towards Confederation, resulting in a demand for changes in the basic constitution of a radical kind. And he goes on to identify some of the factors that are at play. The debate in Quebec over education, which was actually a debate over secularism. The question of whether Quebec was the sole bastion of French culture in North America, or whether the whole of Canada was the proper area for the development of that culture. And he concluded, the greatest crisis as we see it is thus a complex one containing many factors. But the fundamental issue is the relationship between the two, quotes, nations, or the two parts of the single nation. In other terms, the relationship between the two cultural and linguistic groups whose study is the purpose of this commission. These are in a critical state, and the choices now forced upon us all are critical. What that emerged after going through the whole editing process that went through to produce the report, in the preliminary report of 1965, the state of affairs established in 1867 and never seriously challenged is now, for the first time, being rejected by the French Canadians of Quebec. And so you can see that those three or four paragraphs that Scott laid out in that note to his fellow commissioners was condensed into that single definition of what constituted the crisis.
Scott seemed to be in disagreement with Le Rondeau periodically, at least based upon what I read in the journal. And at one point, he pointed out the 11 myths perpetuated by Le Rondeau. What were these 11 myths, or some of these 11 myths, and your sort of reflections on them?
Yeah, Le Rondeau had at the commission talked about some of the myths that English Canadians had about French Canada and about Quebec. And Scott responded by saying, in effect, hey, wait a second, let's look at the myths that there are in French Canada about the country. And he went through them. One, the French were the first in Canada everywhere because they settled on the banks of the St. Lawrence. They're supposed to have some priority in British Columbia. They know practically nothing of the English exploration and first settlement of other parts of North America. The English rights in Quebec come from the French and are evidence of the greater generosity in the treatment of minorities. Actually, English rights in Quebec come from the English, from the time when they controlled the whole province. Three, the French are settlers in Quebec, but the English are invaders. Four, the French are a minority everywhere. This leads them to think that their position is precarious, and therefore they must become independent. Actually, the French majority in Quebec wields an almost undisputed sovereignty over the vast area of provincial jurisdiction. A corollary of this minority myth is that, being a minority, they're perpetually dominated by the majority and do not control its decisions on any important matter. French are willing to learn English, but the English won't learn French. Actually, the British element in Quebec is more bilingual than the French. Lord Durham was an evil monster. Suggestions of this are found even in Le Rondeau's drafting of Chapter 5. To the French, Durham was a great assimilator. To the English, he's a great decolonizer. And this line was picked up in the preliminary report, and some of the other points are summarized. Quebec pays no attention to responsible government. I picked up also the word Le Rondeau put in priest-ridden, and showed that while it is an insulting term from the point of view of Protestant Canada, the fact that Quebec has not a single lay school, college, or university for the French-speaking people, the fact that the place names are predominantly attached to Catholic saints, and the fact that in the Catholic parishes, the parish authorities can use the civil courts to enforce payment of church dues, is understandably going to make the Anglo-Saxon people feel that the influence of the priest in the social life of the province is excessive. I might have mentioned the crucifixes in the courtrooms, but didn't. And then he goes on to talk about the constitutional rights that the French Canadians are second-class citizens, challenging that that there's nothing in common between the two cultures. The English always assimilate minorities everywhere. The corruption, and finally, that the corruption of the French spoken in Quebec is due to the proximity of the English, in which he points out that Joual was found first in the Chicoutimi area, where there are very few English. So it was Scott's recounting of his correcting the record and saying that there are misunderstandings on both sides of the language barrier, and that did reflect itself in the published version of the Royal Commission's report.
So how did Scott and Laurando finally manage to weave their positions together then?
It was quite extraordinary, and I think it speaks to Laurando's success as a conciliator, which was not Scott's natural style. At one point, after one of the meetings, Léon Dion said to him that while everybody was always impressed with Scott's interventions, he somehow never changed their minds after he spoke. He tended to be polarizing rather than unifying, whereas Laurando was much gentler, more conciliatory, much more effective at building a consensus. They had a great deal of respect for one another. Laurando and Scott had known each other since the late 1930s, and while they had very different political positions in a number of ways, that never had an effect on how much they respected each other.
And what was Scott's view of Indigenous identities and languages in Canada, as well as his view of other, that is, non-English, non-French, and even non-Indigenous ethnicities and languages in the context of the commission, given its name, bicultural, bilingual?
That's right. Well, Scott had a very dualistic view of the nature of the country, and there were two academics on the commission who were, one was of Ukraine, Brunitsky, who was of Ukrainian background, and Wyczynski, who was of Polish background. And Scott kind of tolerated them, but would dig in his heels, as the other commissioners did, to prevent a broadening of the definition of official languages. They actually wrote a dissenting minority report arguing that Ukrainian should be recognized as an official language in Western Canada and Italian as an official language in Toronto. And this was not accepted by either Scott or any of the other commissioners. As far as they were concerned, Canada was a country of two official languages. That's the way it should remain. Scott's view of Indigenous languages was even more dismissive, and he didn't feel that the commission should be commenting, or partly, he said, because they didn't know anything about them. But it's clear that this was a report that was conducted when the Aboriginals, the Indigenous peoples of Canada, had not become nearly as vocal or as visible as they did starting in the 1970s. The transformation into the National Indian Brotherhood into the Assembly of First Nations was something that happened in the future. Negotiation of the James Bay Treaty was something that happened in the future. They were simply not aware. At one point, Scott and Jean-Louis Gagnon went up to what was then called Frobisher Bay, now Iqaluit, met some people, came south, and really felt that there was not anything useful that they could say or should say that would be part of the report. There's a paragraph or so at the beginning of the volume one of the Royal Commission explaining that they just they didn't address indigenous languages, and while they wished them all the best luck in the world, that was not part of their mandate, and they weren't going to deal with them.
In your view, what was the impact of the Royal Commission's final recommendations?
Well, I think it's been transformative in a number of ways. It was the Royal Commission that led to the draft, the Official Languages Act, which was introduced in 1968 and passed in 1969, the creation of the Office of the Commissioner of Official Languages. It also, due to the volume that was written on other ethnic groups, led to the recommendations concerning policy of multiculturalism, which did not include recognizing non-English, non-French languages as official languages, but nevertheless laid the groundwork for Canada's multiculturalism policy. I think that the degree to which the federal government, it stimulated the federal government to engage in a massive process of language training, hiring Francophones, and moving towards a situation where now, by and large, the federal government is competently able to serve English-speaking and French-speaking Canadians in the language of their choice. So not completely, not entirely, not 100%, but to a very significant degree, it is now possible to apply for a passport, to fill out your income tax, to get responses from the federal government in the official language of your choice, which just simply was not possible before the recommendations of the official, the Royal Commission.
Well, Graham, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
My guest today was Graham Fraser. We talked about his book, The Fate of Canada, F.R. Scott's Journal of the Royal Commission on Bilingualism and Biculturalism, 1963 to 1971, published by McGill Queen's University Press in 2021. You've been listening to Witness to Yesterday. Please visit our website at www.champlainsociety.ca. The best way you can support this podcast is by becoming a subscribing member of the Champlain Society. If you like what you've heard, let your friends know by forwarding this podcast through the social media of your choice. This podcast is made possible by the members of the Champlain Society who work hard to bring to life original documents in Canadian history. We want to thank the L.R. Wilson Institute of History at McMaster University, as well as a consortium of Canadian scholarly book publishers that includes the University of Toronto Press, the University of British Columbia Press, McGill Queen's University Press, the University of Regina Press, and the University of Ottawa Press. My name is Greg Marshaldon. This interview was recorded on February 1st, 2022. It was produced by Jessica Schmidt.